Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Once again from London Town, ladies and gentlemen, where they made it feel just like New Orleans. They had a big power failure. By the way, when we're planning these war things, just let's keep in mind all of the ancillary victims, all of the collateral damage. Major anti-war demonstration in London yesterday just screwed up traffic all over town. Can we please think about these things in advance? Now, why do I love L.A.? Because it's finally joined the rest of the world. For so many years, ladies and gentlemen, the Los Angeles airport, fine though it may have been in other capacities, had a distinct deficit compared to the other great airports of the world. It was an advertising deficit. You could walk through the entire airport and not see a single billboard. There's still no billboards, but things have started to come the new way. As of July 5th of this year, I'm proud to announce there is now advertising in the bottom of the trays at security, into which you have to put your keys and your shoes and your thing. So, congratulations, LAX, for joining the rest of the human race, because we can't have enough advertising. Now, why do I love the UK? In the midst of a long article on all the cost, both economical and ecological, don't you know, of us drinking bottled water, like what it costs in fossil fuel consumption to ship water from Fiji to England. Think of it. The English newspaper, The Independent, came up with this. 11% of all bottled water sold in the UK is, quote, other purified water, otherwise known as table water. This is reprocessed tap water. The most notorious example of this, I'm still quoting, was the failed attempt by Coca-Cola to market its Dasani brand of water. Dasani failed in England, ladies and gentlemen. Quote, once it became publicly known that the water was glorified, tap water sales dropped and the company quietly dropped the brand. Although there are still restaurants that try to pass it off as natural mineral water and charge their customers a premium for it. Dasani, glorified tap water. Just like Aquafina, by the way. Still dominating the supermarket shelves in the United States, failed in England. That's why there'll always be one. Not an always be a Dasani, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for clearing that up. Hello, welcome to the show. I don't think they're as happy about the sun anymore here in, hello, from London, England, where Green Park is officially being renamed Yellow Park. The drought, ladies and gentlemen. If it weren't for the power shortage, they'd be talking about the drought. From Leicester Square in London, England, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of Le Show, and time for news from outside the bubble. From the Watch the Other Hand department, the most senior British military commander in Afghanistan has described the situation in that country as close to anarchy. With feuding foreign agencies and unethical private security companies compounding problems caused by local corruption. The stark warning came from Lieutenant General David Richards, head of NATO's International Security Force in Afghanistan, who warned that Western forces there were short of equipment. Where have we heard that before? I think he means military equipment. And we're running out of time if they were going to meet the expectations of the Afghan people. You know what I say? I say, why not disappoint them again? The assumption within NATO countries had been that the environment in Afghanistan after the defeat of the Taliban in 2002 would be benign, General Richards said. Quote, that is clearly not the case. He referred to disputes between tribes crossing the border with Pakistan and divisions between religious and secular factions, cynically manipulated by anarcho-warlords. Good name for a band. Corrupt local officials were fueling the problem, and NATO's provincial reconstruction teams in Afghanistan were sending out conflicting signals, General Richards told a group in London where it's safe, if hot. Quote, the situation is close to anarchy, he added, referring in particular to what he called the lack of unity between different agencies. He described poorly regulated private security companies as unethical and all too ready to discharge firearms. NATO forces in Afghanistan were short of aircraft, but also medical evacuation systems and life-saving equipment. A officials said later that France and Turkey had sent troops to Kabul, but without any helicopters to support them. The picture General Richards painted contrasted markedly with optimistic comments by government officials when they agreed earlier this month to send reinforcements to southern Afghanistan at the behest of British commanders there. Many of them would be engineers with the task of appealing to Afghan hearts and minds. General Richards said that was a priority. How to eradicate opium poppies was a problem that could only be tackled later. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now, how much is the war on terror costing us? We were told just before the Iraq war division of that war began, I'll stop talking like that now, that, hey, maybe 50, 60 billion tops, if that, because the Iraq oil exports would probably pay for the war. And you remember General Shinseki, you can still say that on the radio, can't you, was allowed to retire after predicting the war would cost between $150 and $200 billion. The global war on terror, which according to the Bush administration includes the Iraq war, has cost the country at least $430 billion, half a trillion dollars almost, over the past 5 years, according to the watchdog arm of the U.S. Congress, the General Accountability Office. So we are half a trillion dollars safer, ladies and gentlemen. The Middle East is $500 billion more stable, right? Oh, sorry. The GAO warns that future costs may be difficult to estimate because of irregularities in the way the Pentagon does its accounting. Who would have thunk that? And because of unforeseen events in Iraq and Afghanistan. See previous item. The figures are particularly important, says the Asia Times, because they show how much the war is still costing the United States in Iraq and Afghanistan years after both operations began. Oil production in Iraq remains far below the pre-war level of about 2.5 million barrels a day, so that's not going to pay for much of anything. For 2007, the Pentagon has requested another $50 billion for military ops, and other U.S. government agencies have requested about $750 million for reconstruction and stabilization activities. That is going so well. It looks so stable right here on the screen. I'm looking at it. Most of the money went to activities in the war on terror that include combating resistance groups, civil affairs, capacity building, reconstruction operations, and training the military forces of other countries. And they are... It makes me proud. The congressional watchdog signaled its concern over how the Pentagon reports the costs associated with the war on terror. For example, it says through April, the Pentagon reported only $273 billion in incremental costs, which differ from the GAO's findings on money allocated operations. $273 billion. Chump change, baby. DOD's reported war on terror costs and appropriated amounts differ generally because DOD, the Department of Defense's cost reporting, does not capture some items such as intelligence and Army modular force transformation, the report says, as if anybody understands it. The agency says previous problems with the Pentagon's accounting led the GAO to conclude that future costs are likely to be much higher than anticipated. Didn't guys go to jail for accounting irregularities recently, and one died after being convicted? Yes, but they weren't in the Pentagon. You see what I'm saying? GAO's previous work found numerous problems with DOD's processes for recording and reporting the war costs, including the use of estimates instead of actual cost data, and the lack of accurate supporting documentation. Aside from that, the accounting is splendid. GAO says the war on terror will likely involve the continued investment of significant resources. So, pony up. Pay those taxes. So, that's what we're paying. What are we getting? The Washington Post, back in the States, began a multi-part series this weekend, tellingly entitled Fiasco. I wish I had echo here. Let me try it.
Fiasco! Oh.
No, it doesn't work. Fiasco is the title of their series about, guess what war in what Iraq? Fiasco, ladies and gentlemen. $450 billion for a war that the... There's strong evidence, I'm quoting from the first article in the series now. There's strong evidence based on a review of thousands of military documents and hundreds of interviews with military personnel that the U.S. approach to pacifying Iraq in the months after Hussein fell, he's still falling apparently this weekend, helped spur the insurgency and made it bigger and stronger than it might have been. The very setup of the U.S. presence, I'm quoting, the very setup of the U.S. presence in Iraq undercut the mission. The chain of command was hazy. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the few indubitable arrows in the resume quiver of the president is that he's got an MBA from Harvard, Master of Business Administration. The chain of command in Iraq was hazy. Wouldn't that be one thing you could, with no one individual in charge of the overall American effort in Iraq, a structure that led to frequent clashes between military and civilian officials. When L. Paul Bremer, the chief of the Coalition Provisional Authority, issued his first order about 3 years ago, the de-bathification of Iraq society, the CIA station chief in Baghdad warned him against the radical move, saying, quote, by nightfall, you'll have driven 30,000 to 50,000 Baathists underground, and in 6 months, you'll really regret this, unquote. Bremer's order, along with a second that dissolved the Iraqi military and national police, created a class of disenfranchised, threatened leaders. Then there's the U.S. Army's interactions with the civilian population. Based on its experience in Bosnia and Kosovo, the Army thought it could prevail through presence, that is, soldiers demonstrating to Iraqis that they are in the area, mainly by patrolling. We've got that habit that carries over from the Balkans, one Army general said. Back then, the U.S. military jargon for this was boots on the ground, or the presence mission. There's no formal doctrinal basis for this in Army manuals and training that prepare the military for its operations. But the notion crept into the vocabularies. The flaw in this approach, according to Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Holshek, a civil affairs officer, was that after Iraqi public opinion began to turn against the Americans and see them as occupiers, then the presence of troops becomes counterproductive. Few U.S. soldiers seem to understand the centrality of Iraqi pride and the humiliation Iraqi men felt in being overseen by this Western army. Foot patrols in Baghdad were greeted during this time with solemn waves from old men and cheers from children, but with baleful stares from many young Iraqi men. Says Colonel Robert Killebrew, a veteran of Special Forces in the Vietnam War, when you're facing a counterinsurgency, if you get the strategy right, you can get the tactics wrong, and eventually you'll get the tactics right. If you get the strategy wrong and the tactics right at the start, you can refine the tactics forever, but you still lose the war. That's basically what we did in Vietnam. For the first 20 months or so of the American occupation in Iraq, it was what the U.S. military would do there as well. Quote, what you are seeing here is an unconventional war fought conventionally, unquote, a special forces lieutenant gloomily remarking one day in Baghdad as the violence intensified. The tactics the regular troops were using, he added, sometimes subverted American goals. Then there's intelligence. On the morning of April 14th, 2003, Captain William Ponce, an officer in the Human Intelligence Effects Coordination Cell at top military headquarters in Iraq, sent a memo to subordinates asking what interrogation techniques they would like to use. The gloves are coming off regarding these detainees, he said. The 4th Infantry Division's intelligence operation responded 3 days later with suggestions that captives be hit with closed fists and subjected to low-voltage electrocution. Unquote. A series, ongoing series called Fiasco in the Washington Post. But a $500 billion fiasco, ladies and gentlemen. No nickel-dime fiasco. And finally, checking out the war on terror on this lovely weekend, the Bush administration and Congress have slashed millions of dollars from military aid to African nations in recent years, moves that Pentagon officials and senior military commanders say undermine American efforts to combat terrorist threats in Africa and to counter expanding Chinese influence there. Washington has shut down Pentagon programs to train and equip military in a handful of African nations because they have declined to sign statements exempting American troops from the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court in The Hague. The policy designed to protect American troops from prosecution if they should ever do something, oh, you know, like electrocute detainees, has instead angered senior military officials who say the cuts in military aid are short-sighted and have weakened counterterrorism efforts in places where the threat of international terrorism is said to be most acute. Don't you know, ladies and gentlemen? So that's our little survey, the war on terror. We're getting our money's worth and then some. You know what I say? I say spend another $500 billion, and we'll get it right. Or we'll spend another $500 billion. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there's going to be a new PBS documentary by Ken Burns. Please withhold your applause till the entire program is over. A documentary on the war, a soldier's eye view of World War II. How topical. Viewers may see some strange things when the series is broadcast next year on PBS. A new PBS policy that went into effect on May 31st requires producers whose shows are on before 10 in the evening to adhere to tough editing requirements when it comes to coarse language to comply with new tough FCC rulings. Most notably, says the deputy counsel of the PBS operation in a memo to stations, it is no longer enough simply to bleep out offensive words audibly when the camera shows a full view of the speaker's mouth. From now on, the on-camera speaker's mouth must also be digitally masked, a solution that PBS producers call cartoonish and clumsy. Hey, something cartoonish on PBS? I'm watching. In addition, profanities expressed in compound words must be audibly bleeped in their entirety so that viewers cannot decipher the words. In the past, PBS required producers to bleep only the offensive part of the compound word. So I don't think you'll be hearing the word mother on PBS very much anymore if this policy goes into effect. Now, it's, of course, apropos this week because that means that PBS, much like this very station you're listening to right now, has not been able to broadcast the verbatim comments by President Bush to Tony Blair at the G8 summit meeting over the weekend that made such big news around the world. Which, you know, everybody figured out what he was saying, but it's cute and ironic that the FCC keeps us from broadcasting the words of the president. It was an interesting, over here, of course, in England, the main focus was on the perception that the tape gave to an awful lot of observers of Tony Blair, that it reinforced his poodlicity, his poodleness, his poodleism, because the premise being that he said, well, I could go over to the Middle East, and Bush said, no, Condi's going, and that was sort of the end of that. But, of course, in America, I think an awful lot of attention was devoted to the president's language, even though we couldn't broadcast it, and why he might have resorted to it. Now, some say, you know, it was just part of his frat boy persona, but there may be other explanations.
Yo. See, I was hanging with my buds, Angela and Pootie Pooch. She's got a stiff neck, and he's playing cutesy cute. Then Blair comes up behind me just to kind of remind me we got a crisis that we're supposed to do something about. Well, I got half a French roll stuffed in my yap. Tony's talking a half mile of his extra fancy crap. A lap full of crumbs, thinking about those bums in the Mideast just made my inner hip hopper pop out.
Stop doing this shit. Stop doing this shit. Stop doing this shit.
See, the irony is that I would say irony at all. Like I'm suddenly a speaker at the big professor's ball. But when I see what Hezbollah and Herbala, to be fair, are doing over there, it just makes me want to shout. Now, to get to the second coming, we need an Armageddon, so maybe the Jews and Arabs have to crash head-on. I'll send Condi over just to kind of seal it with a kiss, but in the meantime, I just gotta let my inner hip-hopper out.
Stop doing shit. Stop doing shit. Stop doing shit.
Now, sure, I'm a moral man who has God-fearing ways. I wouldn't use a dirty word or worse, a smutty phrase. I've restored dignity to the White House, always coat and tie. My opponents have no values, of that there is no doubt. But I've been too long in Germany, eager to get home. Been too long with foreigners, my attention starts to roam. My high-priced staff doesn't tell me that the damn mic is on, so of course, I just have to let my inner hip-hopper out.
Stop doing shit. Stop doing shit. Stop doing shit.
Building up the new Mideast, that's what it's all about. Takes a lot of bricks, it even takes some grout. Sometimes you got to sputter, sometimes you got to spout, sometimes you just gotta let your inner hip-hopper out.
Stop doing the shit. 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 Stop doing the shit.
Sweat rolling off of this shovel, digging in the devil's boneyard. Sure like a cool drink of water, soft rag to soothe my face. Sure like a woman to talk to in this place. There's 110, 110 in the shade. Going way down, mama, won't you carry me? Pedal so hard I can't stand it. My shrivel up and blow away. Noonday sun make you crazy. At least that's what the old men say. But I'm laying hard as a gravestone. Cut it with an axe. Gonna lay me down right here, and that's a fact. It's 110, 110 in the shade. About leaving, Lord, I guess I never will. Heartache down in that city, bright light scares me anyway. Sure like a woman to talk to in this place. That's 110, 110 in the shade. Going way down.
Chuck.
Yeah.
Chuck.
Yeah.
We're not taking phone calls today, right?
Nope.
So I don't need to wear this.
All right.
Okay. I'm just taking it off. From Boutique 3000, an experimental laboratory in the heart of Beverly Hills, exploring all the wondrous new possibilities for retail, for the woman. This is Strictly from Blackwell and Blackwell. And it pains me to say this. It pains me to say almost everything these days. But it really does pain me to say. What has happened? And I'm asking this in the form of a what if. What has happened to the art of fashion commentary? The red carpet display we see today. It just makes you want to throw, knowing that you, meaning me, have been part of the fashion commentary scene for many years. And when you see people, young people today, just taking the tradition of having good fun with what the fabulous and the famous are wearing, the kind of good fun we have with the list every year, and just turning it into more tack and more trash, it just, as I say, it makes you want to throw. And I don't want to name names, but we must get Joan Rivers back on the red carpet, because she did what she did and does what she did with a dignity and with a respect for the art of fashion commentary in the red carpet, which we just think is totally missing today. Enough said. I'm getting irritable stomach syndrome just from thinking about it. We have a wondrous show today. Spencer and I were in London last week for London Fashion Week. Interestingly enough, it was scheduled for another time. And we met a woman who is now here in the city of Beverly Hills. We're going to have a good conversation with her. And with Sterling Kittles, who is bringing the entire art of pet past life therapy to a new, what do you call it, plateau? Tableau, one of those. Myra Kay is with us. And Myra, as I say, we met in Britain and we had good conversation. We promised we would get her on the show when she came to the city of Beverly Hills. And miraculously, here she is, just as if brought by a plane. Myra, you are doing... Myra is a designer in London. And she has come up with a concept which she thinks, and which we think she thinks, is going to revolutionize the fashion world. Myra, first of all, just
Thank you, Mr. Blackwell. Yeah, it is a pleasure to be with you. It's a pleasure to be here in this wonderful city with so much experimentation and the excitement. It just gives me great hope about Burka Chic.
That's what we want to talk to you about, Myra. Mm-hmm. When we were in London, we saw so many women of a certain style who were walking around in... the burqa?
Burqa, chador.
The chador, is that what it's?
Yes, it is.
And the hijab.
That's right.
I learned this.
Very good.
These are the three. Mm-hmm. But you were trying to take this and walk it up, because that is day wear, as well as cocktail wear, street wear, night wear for these women.
Leisure
you
wear.
Were trying to take it to a different level for a different woman. Mm-hmm. This is what we love.
Yes, Mr. B, it's just been my feeling that the Western woman has been accustomed to a fashion of subtraction, where every season something is less than it was.
Yes.
And this is to be attractive and to be provocative
of
and
course.
All sorts of... And to move fashion ahead, which is wonderful.
No,
but there is a fashion of addition as well as a fashion of subtraction, and that's what we are trying to bring to the fore, so that...
No. When you say fashion of addition, you're saying make a garment with more fabric to cover more of the woman.
That's right.
Okay.
It is a requirement in certain religions
of
that
course.
The woman dressed like this.
Yeah.
But we're trying to turn this into a fashion statement.
Okay.
And burka chic involves basically a statement that...
Yeah, but what you're saying then...
Yes.
Myra, if
yes.
I can.
Mm.
And by the way, the K
yes.
is, stands for what?
It stands for my last name.
Okay, good. We love the air of mystery. So what you were saying, Myra,
yes.
is that black is really the new black.
Yes, Mr. B.
Okay.
The idea is to cover and not to be provocative,
no.
but to be provocative in the lack of provocativity.
Oh,
it is
okay.
a fashion of opposites
yeah.
in which the more that is not seen, the more that,
more that
is seen.
Seen. Okay.
And so, yes, black yeah. is the absence of all color and therefore the presence of all color.
So
black is the new black and it's also the new white.
The new white. Interesting. We're going to get back to you, Myra, and have more good conversation about burka chic and find out exactly where the woman can take on this whole new way of saying, look at me. But Sterling Kittles is here with us. And, you know, we have had many animal psychics on the program. We've never had Sterling Kittles. Interesting.
It is interesting, Mr. Blackwell.
I know.
Probably because I'm the only one that, as far as I know, that's really doing pet past lives therapy.
Yeah, okay.
And we've done it in about 60 cities.
Yeah,
opened clinics to explore the past lives of our animal companions.
Yeah.
And in every case, you know, the results have been astonishing, not just in terms of animal behavior.
No.
But in terms of the human behavior of the human companions.
Of
because
course.
They understand their
animal
friends, so much better.
Yeah.
If you know that your pet schnauzer has, in a past life, been an Egyptian temple dog.
Interesting.
You have a different level of respect when you take him or her for a walk, I think.
Yeah.
And the animal feels that and reciprocates. And so you have a relationship that has been nurtured by that kind of therapy. Now,
Sterling, when you are with the animal, when you do a session, is the owner, and I know you're not supposed to say owner or master, but I don't remember the word you're supposed to say, but is that person there too, or do you communicate to the animal? Do you say to the cow, you used to be what, a peacock?
First of all, in all of my work, Mr. B, and I've been doing this now for 25 years.
No, we know.
In all of my decades of work, I've never experienced a trans species past life. That's
interesting,
very important.
Interesting.
Species tend to repeat their lives within the species just as humans do. You'll rarely come across
a
past life practitioner with humans who finds that, let's say, used to be in another life a monarch butterfly.
Oh, if only.
We just don't think this thing happens. We don't think there's evidence of it.
Okay.
But yes, in answer to your question, the communication does have to go through the human companion.
Through the human. Okay.
I have a deep communicative relationship
with
the animal in question. But it's nonverbal of necessity.
Okay.
And so the human is a very important part of this. And very often,
Dr. Kittles, let me just get to the thing that I think the audience is totally interested in, which is you, unlike an awful lot of practitioners of the mental arts, you're not afraid to tell people the bad news.
Well,
you're not afraid to tell the owner of a collie this used to be a barnyard, junkyard mutt. Interesting.
Well, let me just put it in a nutshell.
Good.
As a pet past life practitioner, Mr. Blackwell, all I have to offer is my credibility.
Incredible.
If I'm just, gilding the lily, gilding
the peacock.
Whatever.
Okay.
You don't need to go to me. You don't go to any fortune teller on the street.
Isn't that something?
I've got to tell the truth or I'm out of business.
Sterling Kittles, we will get back to you. I don't think we'll have the time. Myra Kay.
Yes.
Tell me why the woman who was year after year after year rejected the fashion dictates of the New York crowd is going to adopt as her fashion statement the burqa.
You know, fashion is a pendulum.
Hmm.
The mini skirt.
Interesting.
Was followed by what? The maxi skirt.
The maxi skirt.
So the micro mini, Mr. B, must be followed in its place by the mega maxi, which is burka chic.
The mega maxi.
Yes.
Because it's covering everything.
It's covering everything, and that is the most provocative pose of all.
Well, you know, we have felt this for years, but we have been cowed by the bear-it-all crowd out of saying so. Because there is no more provocative phrase in the English or other language than peekaboo.
Well,
because the lengths are the same, the cut is the same,
yes,
the color is the same, I imagine that what is going to distinguish the premium buyer from the regular off-the-rack buyer of a burka type garment is the fabric.
Fit. Although there's not much fit.
No.
But there are very subtle differences in the drape.
The drape, okay.
Fabric, of course.
Yeah.
There are models for the evening wear.
Okay, good.
The social set that involve the use of gold thread.
Interesting.
Although it is, of course, dyed black.
Dyed black.
But the wearer knows this. there are fine silks we're using. Yeah. The weaves are very fine. And then, of course, for daytime or for casual, it gets nubbier. Looser, but never loose.
Never loose. Okay, good.
No.
And because I'll tell you something, Myra, when I was designing and when I'm commenting on fashion, I ask myself one question, especially with evening wear. Is this the way, if I were a woman, I would want to enter a room?
Mm-hmm.
And having seen your princess line,
yes,
which is the one with the gold thread. And just the most amazing flow and drape,
Thank you.
It would be. Myra Kay, Dr. Sterling Kittles, time is like a burqa that just shrouds us all with its wonderful embrace of blackness. We must flee. Next time, the hat. Is it making a comeback or is it gone with the wind? Until then, Strictly from Blackwell. Bye-bye.
The doors, start the party up once more. Hey, hey, let's get gay, cause stuff is here. Everybody grab a glass, cause the good stuff's about to pass. Hey, hey, let's get gay, cause stuff is here. The animal man falls upon his stool, plays that piano like he's nobody's fool. Everybody grab that glass, cause the good stuff's about to pass. Hey, hey, let's get gay, cause stuff is here. Grab that glass, cause the good stuff's about to pass. Hey, hey, let's get gay, cause stuff is here.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Le Show. And news from the digital wonderland, which there hasn't been that much of lately, but there's always room for more. This is from the a newspaper in Australia, the Canberra Times. And this is a columnist just writing about his experience with the new wonder world. Last week, he says, I sat before the most humongous television set I've seen in my life. It dominated a lounge room, living room, we would say, wall, like a cinema in the home. As an experiment, we flicked backwards and forwards between standard definition and high definition digital transmission. I couldn't discern a difference. My guess is that the vast majority of Australians couldn't either. Or even if they could, they would always prefer four separate standard definition programs to one high definition one. That's one person's opinion, of course, ladies and gentlemen. And we don't even know his name. But there you go. Couldn't tell the difference. It's got to be good if you can't even tell the difference. I remember that you could tell that the worst visioned person in America could tell the difference between black and white and color. That's the only point I'll make about that. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. I know you'd read the trades for me if our positions were reversed. But they're not. From Advertising Age, Walmart tries to be MySpace. I'll read it for you. Dateline Columbus, Ohio. It's a quasi-social networking site for teens designed to allow them to, quote, express their individuality, unquote. Yet it screens all content, tells parents their kids have joined, and forbids users to email one another. And it calls users hubsters. Desperate to appeal to teens with something other than pencils and backpacks during the crucial back-to-school season, Walmart is launching a highly sanitized, controlled, and, says Advertising Age, rather unhip site. Teens are invited to create their own page, show it to the world, and win some fab prizes. Quoting Walmart. Do the kids still say fab? Including a chance to have their videos appear in a Walmart TV commercial. That is so fab. That's almost dope. I don't think they can say that. The opening page shows video of four teens, a bubbly fashionista, a Texas football player, a quirky skateboarder, and an aspiring R&B singer from New York, who are clearly actors reading a script, although the videos are positioned to appear authentic. Within, there are pages such as Beth's Backyard Club, where you find a picture of her in a strapless prom dress above the approved quote, I'll school my way by looking hot in my Walmart clothes to school to catch a cute boy's eye. The site is an attempt at closing the trend gap Walmart now faces as Target wins more teen apparel dollars. If Walmart thought it could win over Amy Candell, 14, of Columbus, Ohio, it was wrong. Quote, some of the kids looked like they were trying to be super cool, but they weren't at all, and they were just being kind of weird, she said. Are these real kids? Nor did it impress 18-year-old Pete Hughes. It just kind of seemed corny to me, he said. Walmart declined to comment. No doubt leery of all the problems with MySpace, owned by Rupert Murdoch, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, for your listening pleasure. Walmart's site disqualifies any video with, quote, materials that are profane. Oh, you can't show the bush? Tony Blair. Disruptive, unlawful, harmful, threatening, abusive, vulgar, obscene, hateful, or racially or ethnically motivated or otherwise objectionable. That's why, quote, pending approval notes dominate pages that are already been created, and content is limited to a headline, a fashion quiz, and a favorite song. Moreover, the retailer reserves the right to edit the commercial created with the winning video, obviously hoping to avoid the fate of Chevrolet's Tahoe, which allowed consumers to create their own video spots unchecked and ended up with some unflattering results. So a subversive, ironic ad by a savvy teen on how her dad's hardware store closed down after the Walmart store opened up would likely be, quote, otherwise objectionable to Walmart. Says Tim Stock, a researcher with the New York-based Scenario DNA, a research firm devoted to studying Generation Y. Why? Because we like you. Quote, the tight controls will work against Walmart's goal to make the site more edgy and will instead cement the retailer's image as a conformist brand. He continues, the second you try to create boundaries and draw a line around content and put a box around content, it becomes something else. Really? Tell it to NBC. He continues again, teens aren't searching for what a company thinks is relevant, but what they deem relevant. You can't own it. When anyone tries to own it too much, then it becomes a problem. Quote, Walmart really needs this to work, says Irma Zandl of youth marketing firm The Zandl Group. Obviously, they didn't spend too much time on their name. She continues, over the last year, we've been getting increasingly bad feedback from teen girls about Walmart, in contrast to Target. Especially Walmart's apparent lack of cleanliness. Messy layout and lack of stylish attire. This attempt at We Media is terrific. We'll have to wait and see if it's enough to overcome in-store issues. Issues, unquote. Like, lack of cleanliness. But it won't change the shopping habits of Molly Morgan, 14, who goes to Walmart only when her mom does to buy groceries and spends her monthly budget at other stores. The Columbus teen, she doubts she'll submit a video or enter the contest because, quote, it, like, takes a lot of time and it's not very likely you'll win. Unquote. The American can-do spirit is alive and well in Columbus, Ohio. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, on this advertising tip, when Kentucky Fried Chicken decided to make a long-dead national hero the star of their latest TV commercial in China, they expected it to help them in their battle for supremacy in the burgeoning Western-style fast food market in China. Instead, KFC became the latest foreign company to be accused of showing a lack of respect for Chinese culture. The controversy over the ad features, which features an aged Taoist monk proclaiming that a chicken burger is a, quote, masterpiece, unquote, is the latest example of a growing backlash against Western influences. KFC's monk drew particular anger as he's based on Fu Qingzhu, I hope that's right, who helped defend China against invaders in the early 17th century. Taoists have ridiculed the commercial, partly because most Taoists are vegetarians. Another angle comes forth when I read the trades for your copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Even though seven halls are getting ready to go. broken promised land.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to wrap this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world to the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, not on Wisconsin Public Radio. Around the world via the internet at two different locations, live and archived, harryshear.com and kcrw.com, whenever you want it. Available as a free download at www.audible.com/theshow and available as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'd be just like throwing another $500 billion at the problem if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you really? All right. Thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack, a tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks, and thanks to Rich and Adrian here at Capital Radio in London Town for assisting in today's broadcast. Note from London, send water. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.